Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Courtside with Nealinson Tennis, part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. Here with my co-host, Steve Flink. We're doing this again on Saturday, Steve. We normally do these Monday nights, Tuesday nights, whatever. But last Saturday, we did it at the early stage of the tournament. We're doing it now to catch everybody up to current day. There's so much that we need to talk about. We both felt that if we were to do everything on our Monday night recording, it was just too packed in. So for our listeners, pay attention because we're going to be hitting a lot of different topics. Steve, what a week. What a first week.
Yeah, it was. You know, and we had a little bit of everything, you know, between Rafa having to pull out of the tournament and Novak making that surprisingly early departure. And then suddenly we got day after day of some very gripping matches. So I think now we're getting down the home stretch, and despite some bad weather in Indian Wells, they've had a terrific tournament.
Yeah. Okay. So to timestamp it for everybody, it's Saturday afternoon around 2 o'clock Eastern time. The men's semis have not yet started. We'll probably get this out later this afternoon or maybe this evening. So maybe one or two of those matches will be over. Don't worry about that. Steve and I will cover the semis and the finals of both the men and the women on Monday night when we do our recording. So let's go back exactly 7 days ago today, Steve. And I will mention the name Peyton Stearns. And this person is not, maybe a lot of people have not heard of her, but Peyton made the third round of the French Open. She's made the fourth round of the US Open. This was a dominant junior. She dominated at University of Texas, winning the NCAAs. She's already made her mark in the pros. And this kid, Steve, I'm telling you, she has a fire inside of her. She has a competitiveness, and she has a belief. And she was up 5-4, 40 love serving against Aryna Sabalenka. It didn't quite work out. But I'm telling you, tennis listeners, be on the lookout for Peyton Stearns.
Well, she gave I agree. I mean, she gave a glowing account of herself that evening, and the crowd was exhilarated and inspired deeply by her performance. As you say, 5-4, 40 love, then a fourth match point in that game as well. But then they go to a tiebreaker, and she saves three match points before bowing out very gallantly. And this was largely Sabalenka taking the match out of her hands with tremendous poise under pressure and very aggressive shot making. So I think that she should be delighted with her performance in defeat. It's not one of those losses that should linger. Like, how did I let that get away? More so, I was on the brink. Sabalenka was too good when it counted, but I'm here to stay. I think that's her attitude.
I think I've said this before, at any level, recreational, collegiate, high school, pros, if you play tennis enough, if you play enough matches, Steve, you're going to win matches that you have no business winning, and you're going to lose matches that you should never, ever lose. It's just, that's part of tennis. And again, you see it at every level. It hurt, obviously, for Peyton in this match. But again, I'll ask you, Steve, like,
David, just a quick point on that. Just a quick point on that, just to back up what you, to reinforce what you're saying. Think how brilliant the devisors of the scoring system were. What's the only change in the scoring system we've really had over the years? The tiebreaker. But otherwise, that original 15-30-40 game, it's so hard to close out games. It's so difficult to close out sets. And it's even that much tougher to close out matches. So I just think they had foresight. That scoring system is held up. You can't run out the clock. A lot of it has to do with that scoring system, because obviously in team sports, you know, you have a certain lead at a certain point, and you can sit on that lead, and it's almost inevitable that you're going to win. Tennis is just not that way.
Tennis and golf, there's no clock. Yeah. You got to make that final putt. It is unbelievable. But what I want to ask you about Peyton, Steve, are you seeing in her what I'm seeing, that belief? And I think it could be taught, the confidence, the inner belief and all that. It can be taught a little bit, but I also think a lot of that is innate. And that kid has it, Steve.
She does. She showed a lot of composure. She didn't get flustered when she was disappointed. You could see there was some frustration, but she battled on so fiercely. And no, I like her temperament, and I want to see more big matches like that. But you were the one, you'd seen more of her than I had prior to that match. Now I'll have my eyes on her. I'll be watching her a lot and anticipating a great deal of success.
Peyton Stearns, keep that name at the top of your head because we're going to see a lot of her. All right. Another person that I was impressed with, she didn't go very far in the tournament, but she played better than I've seen and a lot of others have seen her play in a long, long time. Emma Raducanu. She lost to Sabalenka. Emma played pretty well that match. She was one of 10 on break points, which was the killer, but that was the most impressive that I've seen Emma play in a long, long time.
I'd say she probably feels the same way. I would say disappointed not to be able to close out the second set. I think she had 5-3, and she could well have been into a third set. But it's a step up, and there seems to be more stability with her now. She seems to be enjoying it. Hopefully, she remains injury-free, because I just would hate to see that great championship run at the U.S. Open go wasted. We were all anticipating so much, expecting so much from her. Maybe we were expecting too much too soon. But now I see her sort of making her way back to the top, toward the top 20, and we'll see where she goes from there. That was a fine showing.
Someone who's going to get back up to the top. She was at the top. She went away for a little while. She's going to get back up to the top real soon. That's Naomi Osaka. She lost to Elise Mertens, but the it was tight match. The balls that Osaka was missing, she's going to be making those real soon. I think it's just more matches, but she has it, and I am a firm belief that she's going to be up there with Rybakina, Sabalenka, Iga, fighting in the latter stages of the biggest tournaments of the world.
I think so too. I like the way she was hitting the ball. She also was very composed and coming from two breaks down at the beginning of that match, 3-love, two breaks down, right back on serve, up 5-4 on serve, and a couple of points from winning the first set. She also made a real go of it, breaking back in the second set before bowing out. So I feel like Naomi just needs, she needs those matches. She just needs more matches, and it's going to happen. I don't think it will happen immediately. Maybe Miami. Maybe she can do something good in Miami. Then the clay court circuit, where she doesn't figure to do as well. She's still not really at her best on the slowest courts. But from Wimbledon on, I that's where I expect some remarkable results from her. And I think by the U.S. Open, she can be a contender.
The summer hard court swing is when she could really, really make her move. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Grigor Dimitrov. I mean, the guy is playing arguably the best tennis of his career. And, you know, I was texting you a few days ago. I'm like, it's just like too bad. It's kind of been his whole career. There's just a few too many guys that are just slightly better than him. But I mean, if you watch Grigor play, I mean, he was unbelievable. His fitness is unbelievable. His movement is unbelievable. He's hitting the ball so, so clean. It's just great to see him playing this well.
No, listen, I would agree with you. His level is as high as it's ever been. And he had a great conclusion to 2023 and runner-up to Novak in Paris and beat Medvedev there, had a win over Alcaraz, starting this year off beautifully. You're right. He lost to Medvedev here in a well-played match. And what can you say? Medvedev is going to beat him more than he's going to beat Medvedev. But he is dangerous against the top players on his day, and he's going to beat a lot of the other guys. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Grigor finish somewhere between, 10 and 15 in the world and end of this year, which is extraordinary.
Let's jump to Taylor Fritz, because this is a guy who's playing Holger Rune, playing so well. It was a round of 16 match. It was a round of 16 match.
Right.
And he's up 6-2, 5-4, has a match point. He missed the return, but it was a tough second serve into his body. At that point, and you saw Rune starting to gradually play better. But I mean, up in that point, Taylor was dominating. And then once Taylor missed that break point, match point, actually, break point and match point, Holger Rune caught on fire and was hitting the ball, cracking the ball so clean that I'm thinking to myself, Taylor has to sprint and win this tiebreak and get off the court. Because if it went to a third set, which it did, he has no chance. And unfortunately for Taylor, that's exactly what happened. Holger won it pretty easily.
Yeah, it was like two different matches. Fritz was just, he was sparkling for a set and a half. I mean, he could do no wrong. He had the upper hand in the rallies. He was taking control of the rallies with his power. He had Holger Rune on his heels. And you could see the look on Rune's face. He didn't feel there was much hope at that point. Now, there was one other chance even before the match point that you mentioned in the previous service game where Runa was at 3-4 and 15-30, and Taylor missed a volley from pretty close range, backhand drop volley that you should have made. Could have given them a couple of break points to be able to serve the match out. And then the match point happened in the 10th game. And then he got completely outplayed in the tiebreak and inevitably lost to serve once in the third, and that was all she wrote. And I felt sorry for Fritz. He never quite knew what hit him. He was so confident and is so much in command of the match. But Holger Rune he's one of those players that he can be electrifying, and he can have these patches in matches, and he is capable of making those types of comebacks because of his shot making ability. It was really, and he played, by the way, quite well against Medvedev, but the score does not do him justice in a 5-4 match, because he played really great tennis against Medvedev as well. He's on the cusp of it now. And what I'm encouraged about with Rune, by the way, is that physically things look a little bit better. We've seen too many times when the trainer's out and something's wrong with his leg, and he's so tense that he's bringing about the injuries through this, you know, maybe excessive intensity. Who knows what it is, but there've been too many episodes like that. This I thought he was holding up physically very well in both the Fritz match and the Medvedev contest, which were very physical matches. So I like where we're headed with him, because he loves the clay. You know, clay is actually his best surface. So pretty soon he'll be out on the clay and playing maybe his best tennis. So that was a good tournament for him. Fritz should not be discouraged. He got beaten. He didn't beat himself, but I'm sure he came off the court a little shell-shocked, because he was on his way to what looked like an emphatic straight set win that turned into a shattering three set defeat.
I could not believe how on point Rune was on Taylor's serve every return when it got to those late stages, the second set and then the third. I mean, Taylor would finish his swing on the serve, and by the time Taylor got to, the ball was already at his feet. They were deep, and then Holger was just cracking every ball. There was really, like you said, there was nothing Taylor could do. It's not like he lost the match. There was just nothing he could do.
No, Rune, it was the classic case of a player going in the zone, and he got unconscious. And all credit to him, because nobody was going to make him conscious again. He played that way right through the end of the match, really from the middle of the second to the end of the third. He was almost letter perfect.
All right, let's talk Novak. And he's obviously concerned. He's had two losses that, for him, it's not so much that he lost, it's just the way that he lost. I mean, losing in the Australian Open to Sinner, right? I mean, how many unforced errors do you have? 50-something unforced errors in that match? I mean, 54 unforced errors. Very uncharacteristic. But again, losing to Sinner's hot as can be right now. No shame in that. This now is a shocker, right? Is this something that Novak should really be concerned about? Do you think this will be a pattern that Novak's going to start losing to people not named Sinner or Alcaraz? I don't think so. I think this was a total outlier. Yes, he withdrew from Miami, so we won't see him now until the clay. But this was an outlier to me, and I'm not as concerned as maybe some others are. We obviously don't know how concerned Novak himself and his team are, but I think this was a total outlier. Yes, he's going to have difficult matches. He's not going to steamroll the likes of Carlos and Sinner every tournament anymore. They're just getting better, right? And Novak's getting older. But to say that this is the downfall of Novak, I think you're way too quick if anyone would say something like that.
Well, look, there's a couple of things. First, people really forget too quickly that last year was one of the best seasons of his entire career. He won 7 titles. 3 of those were majors, was in the Wimbledon final, very close to winning that before losing in 5. Won 2 Masters 1000s, won the year-end championships. It was a spectacular season. And then he wasn't quite right in Australia between his health and he'd come in with a little wrist issue. Things were never quite right there. And then he played a really atypical match against Sinner with all the errors. This was different, David, because I think the problem was he still has only played 11 matches in all of this season. We're into March. He's got 11 matches under his belt. That's not many. He played the team event before the Australian Open, then the semis of Australia, and then won one match here in Indian Wells. And I feel like he would have been helped had he gone to Dubai the way he has many other seasons and played that tournament in between Australia and Indian Wells. he just feels like he needs these breaks now. That's his concession to age. Maybe he'll reevaluate a little. Who knows? I think he will play a lot on the clay leading up to Paris. No, if anything, I don't think he was disconsolate so much. He was angry at himself. He was really upset with himself. You don't often hear him say how my level was very, very bad. Maybe similar comments about the first two sets against Sinner in Australia. Yes, because that was a different kind of bad. This time he was too defensive. And that's the part that surprised me the most was he said, I didn't have enough on my ball. He said, he couldn't quite figure out why he was so tight in the third, because to come from a set down, win the second, that can happen against a player you haven't met before. But then you figure, no way does he lose the third set once he gets in there. And he was really never, he was hanging on in the third. It was one break and he never came close to breaking Nardi. And as he said, he kind of helped Nardi along with his level. So I think he made Nardi look better than he really is. No, I don't think there's any long-term ramifications here. I think he needs to just get a lot of matches on his way to Paris, do as well as he can, and try to get a title along the way, maybe win Rome again, where he's had so much success in the past, but get plenty of matches and come to Paris where he's in search of a fourth title at Roland Garros. People forget how three titles, and he's won it two of the last 3 years. So he's going to be priming for Roland Garros again, and I think he'll put this behind him in a hurry. Physically, nothing looked wrong. He seemed fine physically. I think it's just a question. He needs the match play, and he's had too much success over too long a period in his career to let this loss put him into the doldrums. He'll come out of it quickly.
I agree. I agree with that. And hopefully once he gets on the clay, he gets a lot of matches behind him and he starts playing like he expects of himself. All right. I want to talk about last night, one of the women's semis. Two players that I love, I was going to be happy regardless of the outcome. And that was Maria Sakkari beating Coco Gauff in three sets. A couple things, and then I'll pass it over to you for your thoughts. And I'll say this, and I think Coco would agree with me. Coco was one set away from being in the final, Steve. I don't think Coco played well at all this tournament, with the exception of one match against Elise Mertens. Her first two matches were not that great. She gets through Elise Mertens. The next match, she double faults, 17 times? She was not sharp. Now, getting as far as she did, semifinals, one set away from being the final, that speaks more of her taking on the personality of maybe her coach, Brad Gilbert, winning ugly, because a lot of players may not have gotten nearly as far as Coco did. I don't think she was sharp. And then again, I'll turn to Maria Sakkari. I've been a fan of her since her great 2021. It's been rough going since then. The coaching change had to happen. We didn't know who she was going to pick. But then when Jess and David Witt separated, David Witt, he's had so much success with Venus Williams, Jessica Pegula. What a gem of a find for Maria Sakkari to add to her team. And she's what? She's beaten Garcia, Puri, Emma Navarro, who had an amazing tournament, who beat Sabalenka, and then Coco late last night.
Well, let's start with Coco. I agree with you. I mean, there's no question that she only played the one really top of the line match. The rest of them, a lot of ups and downs. She's struggling with her forehand again. As far as winning those matches, I think she deserves a lot of credit. She came into last night's match with a 44-22 career record in three setters. So she won 2/3 of your three set matches. That says something about her as a competitor, that she can win on her worst days or on her bad days. Obviously, but you don't want to do it that way. Listen, the U.S. Open, there were so many struggles in the U.S. Open, including capped off by the three set win over Sabalenka in the finals. That seems to be her nature. Now, obviously, I think she and Gilbert would like to change that and have her winning more straight set matches. But last night's was an unusual one. It's the kind of match you figure she usually wins and Sakkari often loses, in the sense that Sakkari totally outplayed her up until 6-4, 5-2. That had some rain delays earlier. It wasn't an easy evening for either of them. But Sakkari's up a set and two breaks, 5-2, serving for the match. Coco wins two quick games and then saves three match points when Sakkari served for the match the second time. And none of those were really Sakkari's fault. All of them were aggressively played points by Coco. So we go to the tiebreaker. Coco almost had it at 6-5, and Sakkari had a gutsy hold from love 30. Coco to 6-2 in the breaker, and Sakari got it back to 6-5 before Coco hit a service winner to Sakari's forehand. It's one set all, and then Coco goes up an immediate break in the third set, David. She breaks her in the first game of the third, but Sakari won the next four games, and eventually it was six of the last seven to win the set 6-2. But these were hard-fought games, game points for Coco, break points for Coco. It was a very determined performance. Sakari really, I give her so much credit because it was so jarring, obviously, to lose the second set after having the 5-2-2 break lead and the three match points. But she regrouped beautifully in the third, and there was a lot of great tennis in that match. But Coco is definitely, the forehand was so sporadic. It just, she'd have find the range for two or three games and then start missing badly. And what's alarming about her forehand is that when she starts to miss it, she can miss it by feet or halfway up the net, shank it. These are not like Seb Korda forehand down the line misses where he looks in agony and they show the replay and it's quarter of an inch wide. These are bad misses. So Sakari to her really pummeled away at Coco's forehand. And I would say it's the best tennis. I haven't seen Sakari play that well, David, maybe since 21. It's hard to say 21, 22. But she was so good from the backcourt. She was much more solid from the baseline, but also aggressive. Serve could have been better at times in the last set and a half. It was very good up to a set and 5-2. But this has been a really uplifting week for her to beat Coco and earn the right to play Iga for the title. And she has a 3-2 record against Iga Swiatek, which is surprising, but Iga's won the last two. So either way, Sakari's got nothing to lose in that final. I expect Swiatek to win it. But even as long as Sakari gives a good performance and plays well in the final, she'll take a lot away from this week, and I think she'll be off and running.
Yeah, no, I agree. And we won't make predictions or whatever because we're going to talk about it on Monday night when we do the women's final, Iga Swiatek. She's lost like 18 games to get her. She's smoked pretty much everybody. It'll be interesting how Sakari matches up with her. Let's talk briefly about the men's semis. Again, we'll do the wrap-up of the semis and the final early next week. Tommy Paul, I mean, he's had a great he obviously took advantage of the draw when Novak lost because he beat Nardi in the round of 16. Tommy has had opportunities like that where the draw has opened up for him previously, and he's not taken advantage of it. This time he did, and then in the quarters beat Casper Ruud, which was a good win for him. He plays Daniil Medvedev. That's going to be a tough one for Tommy. And then the one that everybody's really been talking about is the Sinner-Alcaraz rivalry continues. I'm thinking 7-6, 7-5 in the third for somebody. I don't know who.
Well, my call has been, I've been thinking about this for days, and I don't know why I keep coming up with this score, but I have Sinner winning 7-6, 5-7, 7-6. Optimistic in the sense of every set being that close, but if both of them are playing at their best, it's entirely possible too. I can't imagine we're not going to get a great match. You got Sinner, who has not lost all year long, who's won his first major to start the year, that's just fueled him with confidence. And I think he's lost his serve twice all week. He's the serve is the most improved part of his game, I think. Maybe the return is a close second. So I just think he's going to make Carlos beat him. But we all know that the scenario there is he's just a slightly better percentage player and his percentage tactics pay off in the end. But there's always the possibility that Carlos, with his explosiveness and his love of this court and being the defending champion, and he just seems to enjoy this hard court as much as any all season. And he has an opportunity. He goes out there, and a strange feeling for him, for someone who's been number one, who had that number one ranking for a number of weeks, like Novak took it away from him. But Carlos suddenly comes into this match as a decided underdog. Underdog.
Yeah, not decided, an underdog, yeah.
No, but I mean, I just think he's lost the last two to him. He hasn't won a tournament since Wimbledon last year. In that sense, what his form has been leading up to this, but it's balanced by the fact that he's played very well here after losing his first set in his opening match. And then he's really found his highest level, looked terrific against Zverev in the last round, took him apart. And Zverev had beaten him the previous two times, both at the year-end championships and again at the Australian Open. So
he's looked to me like he's getting back to himself, Carlos.
You said it, though, getting back. The question is, can he get all the way back? It's going to take maybe 101% to beat Sinner, but he's capable of it. And I think, again, the crowd will be excited. Crowd will be very torn, I think. But a lot of times when Carlos is playing his most electrifying brand of tennis, they can't help but side with him. And he plays to the crowd perhaps a bit more than Sinner. And I don't mean that in a critical way. I mean, he loves to connect with the crowds and often does when he's playing well. So I just think we're in for a dandy. I just feel like the reason I give Sinner that slightest edge is because of his serve, because of his consistency. And I feel the other thing, David, is that he's so much better. Yeah, he beat Carlos the last two times last year, including once indoor in the fall. And you can say Carlos wasn't at his best in that stretch. Beat him in Miami last year, Sinner, after losing to him here, and then again in the fall. But if you look at how much progress he's made since then, that's why I consider him the favorite. I'm not overconfident about my prediction because I have so much respect for Carlos when he's soaring. And when he's soaring, he is obviously capable of beating anybody on his day. And he's in that mood now. And I think he senses an opportunity. In turn, Sinner is like, look, I've worked hard. I can get to number two in the world if I win this match. I'm the guy that's been dominating the game this year and who finished last year. Most people feel like for the last 6 months, maybe he's played better than anybody. Djokovic had a great fall as well. But they have a lot. There's a lot on the line is my point for both of them. A lot on the line and little to separate them. I mean, you think of the U.S. Open match in 2022 where Carlos saved a match point against Sinner and won in five. And you think of that hard-fought three-setter in Miami last year. And when they're both playing well against each other, that it's only a thin line that separates them. I just feel like Sinner right now goes in as the more confident of the two. That could change in the course of the match, but he goes in with that attitude of, if I'm at my best, I'm going to win today. On the other hand, maybe Carlos does not feel any different.
Yeah, no, it's well said. We're all looking forward to watching that match. And you're speaking of Sinner. There's a good article that you wrote, Steve, for the listeners who are USPTA members, the USPTA New Advantage latest issue. Again, it's USPTA Advantage. It's the latest issue. It's part of the RSI magazine. It's within that magazine. Steve, you wrote a really nice piece on Jannik Sinner. So for those that get that magazine, take a look. I'm going to let you go because we got to get ready to watch two great men's matches. We're going to try to get this pod out as soon as possible. And then we're going to do this again Monday night with a release, most likely Tuesday night, where we will wrap up the men's semis, the men's final, and the women's final. So thank you for your time, Steve.
Well, I think the fans are in for a treat, and so are we, David, today. And let's just hope that both of those guys are physically at their best and they're playing their best brand of tennis, because we can't go wrong if that's the case. And let's face it, it's the rivalry that we're going to be talking about for the next 10 years. They're going to play so many critical matches against each other. So this will be one among many.
Can't wait. Thanks, Steve.